Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, premium bonds are to get a little less tasty from March, so how do they stack up now against other savings products? Big news for Bitcoin, but how will a decision in the US affect investors over here? Also today, could millions of drivers be owed compensation in another PPI-sized scandal? And 0% beer, it's for life, not just for dry January. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, poor Lee Boyce. Zilch. Zilch from his premium bonds in the last 18 months. And the chances of him winning big in the next 18 months are looking a little bit slimmer. From March, the prize fund has been cut to 4.4% from the 24-year high of 4.65%. The odds of being a winner will remain the same at 21,000 to 1, but there will be fewer big prizes. Lee Boyce, you were discussing premium bonds last week. That's where we discovered I won big with 50. It wasn't big. But anyway, Lee, explain. How does the rate on premium bonds actually work? Because it's not as simple as a savings account rate, is it? So what does this mean that's being cut from 4.65 to 4.4?
Yeah, so it doesn't work like an interest rate does on a traditional savings account. I think that's probably the crucial piece of information that people should get their wrap their heads around. So yeah, last week I was talking about how I've got premium bonds and didn't win a prize whatsoever. So my interest rate last year on my premium bonds was a big fat 0%. What it is really, this rate, is it's almost like a kind of barometer of what they're doing with the prizes, NS&I, and how many prizes are out there and how they split the prizes down. And basically, some people will get under that rate, advertised rate, and some people will get far higher than that rate. And the thing is now, so we've gone from, essentially, NS&I made six rises to the premium bonds last year. So it went up quite a lot. It was in the press a lot. A lot of people were piling money in. So it went up from January, it was at 3%. Then in February, it's 3.15, March 3.3, July 3.7, August 4. And then there was a big one between August and September, which went to 4.65%. That's the highest premium bond rate for a very, very long time. And lots of people have piled cash in. Something like 1.35 billion has poured in since that September rise. It's 550 million odd went in last month alone. People like their premium bonds. People like to put money in there. They like that kind of, you know, in it to win it kind of philosophy. You know, there's still £2-1 million prizes every month, and there will be from March when this cut comes in. So the cut is down to 4.4%. But there will be fewer £100,000 prizes and £50,000 prizes. So, for example, in the January draw, there was 91 prizes of £100,000. From March, that would be 85. And in December, there were 182 prizes of £50,000. And then from March, that would be down to 170. So they're sort of tinkering with those kind of levels. The odds of winning a prize with any one bond is 21,000 to 1. But what NS&I are going to be doing from March is they're pumping way more £25 prizes back into the prize fund. So that has been cut quite a lot in the last year, the number of £25 prizes. But there's going to be 1.4 million of them in March versus just over a million in January. So that's quite a big bump up. It's 37% more £25 prizes in there. So you can see they have to sort of like balance all of these prizes to get that underlying rate. The reason why they're doing this is quite simply, they've hit their funding targets. So NS&I will have targets of how much money they can rake in and how much money, you know, the limit is, essentially. And if it looks like they're going to start breaching these limits over the financial year, they'll start tinkering with the rates. The reason why they were going up last year is simply savings rates just went through the roof. So there was lots of interest in opening up fixed rate accounts, easy access accounts. So lots of money was getting diverted into those kind of products. You can get 5.2% on an easy access rate, and that is a guaranteed rate of return. You're going to get that 5.2%. With premium bonds, you're never quite sure what return you're going to get. It's all down to your sort of average luck on what you're going to actually receive interest wise. But to be honest, I think that the majority of people put their money in premium bonds because it's almost like it's sort of essentially like playing the lottery, but being able to get your stake back. And people like to think that they could win £1 million, £100,000, £50,000. And actually, in this week, premium bonds went a bit viral. I don't know if you saw this, Georgie, on Twitter, but someone posted up about how a very small holding won a very big prize. And that's what captures the imagination of people putting money into premium bonds. You know, if you can get a return of, you know, 100,000% or whatever, because you've got 500 quid in premium bonds and you win a 50 grand prize. People love that kind of sort of like, I'm there every month, my money's in there. But then a lot of the experts say, you know, really, there's no point of holding small amounts in premium bonds because the likelihood of winning the prize is so slim.
When you say small amounts, what do we mean small amounts? Because obviously you can get up to 50,000, but, you know, are we talking 500, 5,000, 15,000?
I think so. The average holding of premium bonds, this was last year when I asked NS&I, it was something like £5,500. So that's the kind of average holding. But there's a lot of people that do max out that 50 grand. And if you've got 50 grand in premium bonds, you've got, you know, way higher chance of winning prizes. You know, that's just the kind of how it works. And we did some research on this before, and something like half of the prizes were being won by people with like £50,000. But then you've got something like that that goes viral on Twitter, and you look through the prize draw, and you can do it from the December draw. You can have a look in the January draw. You can have a look at the sort of smallest holdings that are winning big prizes. You know, and that's what keeps people interested. Now, yeah, what constitutes a small amount? Well, it's a kind of hard one, isn't it? Lots of people open up accounts for kids, for example, and they might have smaller amounts in there. Some people might just like to have this sort of kind of skin in the game by having a small amount in there. So look, let me give you an example, right? So in January, there was someone who bought their bond in August 2008. They hold a total of £200. They come from Essex. It's not me. And they won £100,000. You know, that kind of thing, I think, is what people kind of get excited by. But then you have a look through, you know, I'm just skimming this here. I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, 7. I'm only right at the top of the table here of people that hold a maximum of £50,000. So what I think, this is my personal viewpoint. I'm hodling premium bonds, Georgie. You know, you talk about hodling Bitcoin, holding on for dear life. I'm just keeping hold of my premium bonds. I'm not expecting any kind of return on them, but I've got savings elsewhere. You know, I haven't got all of my eggs in the premium bond basket, so to speak. Yeah. And I kind of just like being involved. I like that kind of sort of every month, start of the month, checking, have I won anything? No, not won anything again. But there will be some time that I'll win a little prize, I'll get that email, and I'll be quite excited. And that's what I think people like. But you cannot bank on premium bonds to give you a solid rate of return. And it depends what you need the money for, what you want to be doing with it. But you can get good rates elsewhere that can trump premium bonds. And if you want a guaranteed return on your cash, premium bonds probably aren't the one for you.
Well, that's it, Lee. How do they stack up against other savings products now? Well, I mean, what can you get? What's out there? Because the last time we spoke properly about this, you know, rates were dipping quite substantially.
Yeah, and they have been dipping for the last couple of months, to be quite honest. I mean, it's a tale of kind of fixed rates are definitely tailing off. So we keep talking about this 6.2% rate that was handed out by NS&I back at the tail end of last year. Well, ever since then, and that product was pulled, you know, that seems like a very smart move now, getting that 6.2% rate, because it beats inflation by quite some way. You can get 5.5% now on a 1-year fix. You can't actually beat that. So fixing for longer than that, you're going to get a lower rate because the market's been flipped upside down, and it still is upside down. But you can get 5.5% over 1 year. The gap between the best fixes and easy access is narrowed massively. So the best easy access rate you can get is 5.2%. If you compare that to fixed rates, you cannot fix, other than for 1 year, you can't beat that 5.2% rate. And there's only 3 1-year fixes that beat that 5.2% easy access rate. So easy access rates have kind of continued to sort of hold steady. But fixed rates have definitely been on the climb down. But they're, you know, as we were just discussing, they're a completely different product to premium bonds. It's really hard to compare premium bonds to anything. It's sort of part savings account, part lottery, is the way I view it. And if you're someone that's thinking about getting involved, or you've got money in it and you're thinking about pulling it out because, you know, you want to get a rate of return elsewhere, or you think that this lowering of this is just basically made it, you know, less attractive to you, it's just about weighing up all the options, isn't it? And what you need the money for, and whether you need a solid return on your money, or whether you just like that thrill of being part of the premium bonds draw.
Simon, your views?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you have to think about if you're going to put your money in premium bonds. And as Lee said, there is a lot of money in premium bonds. And they have actually, I think, become a victim of their own success over the past year. Because if you look at what NS&I said when they cut the rate, Andrew Westhead, NS&I retail director, said, "These changes reflect our requirements to strike a balance between the interests of our savers, taxpayers, and the stability of the broader financial services sector. In a dynamic savings market, it's important that our rates are set in an appropriate position against those of our competitors as we work towards meeting our annual net financing target." To translate that, we've had too much money rushing into premium bonds and it's starting to skew the market, is what he's saying. So we're going to have to dial this back a little bit. They're not dialing it back by loads. You know, they could take as much off this rate as they want to. They could chop that. If they've got way too much money going in, they could chop that rate from 4.65% to 3.65%. Even then, they'll still get money going into premium bonds because they're premium bonds, but they will get less money going in. But they're just easing it back a bit. They're not totally throttling it. So that's quite interesting. But lots of people put a lot of money into premium bonds. There are quite a lot of people who have small amounts in there. They need to be aware, as Lee mentioned, that they're less likely to win a prize. They're less likely to get the average return if they hold below a certain amount. But then you've got people who've got lots of money in there. And I think that premium bonds are actually more directly comparable to a cash ISA than a standard savings account. So you need to think about that one. So the return is tax-free. And actually, they're comparable to what I would say is the best kind of ISA and the kind that people should seek out, which I've talked about on this podcast before, which is what you need is you need a flexible ISA. This was a function that was introduced some years ago, but hasn't massively caught on. Not every ISA is flexible. Loads of people don't know about this. But what this means is that you've got your £20,000 allowance, which you're capped at every year. And that stops people using ISAs as kind of their rainy day pot because they think, oh, well, if I take the money out, I can't put it back in and I earn my ISA allowance, despite the fact that most people will never get anywhere near being able to stick £20,000 into their savings or investments, into their ISA in any year. But it acts as a kind of behavioral block to people. If you have a flexible cash ISA, you take money out and you can put it back in within the same tax year. And that means that it keeps its tax-free protection. And it's really important to protect your savings from tax at the moment because the savings allowance hasn't risen in years. It's still exactly where it was, hasn't gone up with inflation, and it also hasn't gone up as interest rates have gone up. So the amount that you can earn tax-free is £1,000 as a basic rate taxpayer. It's only £500 if you're a higher rate taxpayer, and loads more people have been pulled into higher rate tax thanks to fiscal drag. So there's loads more people paying tax on their savings. So it's more important to get into an ISA. And the great bit there is you don't have to put the details on a tax return. If you get a flexible ISA, take the money out, put the money back in as you like within the same tax year. Premium bonds are kind of the same. You get your return tax-free. You can take your money out when you want. It'll only take you about 2 days to get it, and you can put it back in whenever you want. You might have to wait a bit to get into the draw. So it's not exactly the same, but it's kind of broadly similar to that. And I think people need to think about it in that way. The best flexible ISA, by the way, on the market at the moment is Zopa, and it pays 5.08%. It's not the absolute highest rate, but it doesn't have a bonus on it, so it won't drop after a year. And it accepts transfers, and it's probably the one to go for. But also the other thing you need to think about if you've got lots of money in premium bonds is whether you should be investing that money instead. Mm. Now, if you invest that money, it's highly unlikely that you are going to turn it into £1 million. Not with the kind of rate of return that is available to someone even if they have the maximum premium bond holding and they win £1 million. Okay, that's just, it's not going to happen to you. But it's also highly unlikely that you're ever actually going to win £1 million on the premium bonds anyway. I hate to break it to all our listeners who are holding out for that as their kind of life goal, but it's probably not going to happen. So what you're foregoing is you're foregoing the returns on a savings account, which we talked about, you compare it to, but you're also foregoing the returns on investing. And if you have a large amount sitting in there that you never dip into, that's the kind of money that you could be investing instead. And over 1 year, it probably won't make that much of a difference. In fact, over some years, you'll end up because the stock market will fall and you'll get the average rate of return on the premium bonds and you'll be quids in. But over the longer term, it starts to make a big difference. So the MSCI World Index, which is basically like the global stock market, right? Last year went gangbusters, largely thanks to the magnificent seven stocks in the S&P 500, but that had a return of 24%. That definitely beats the average return on premium bonds. Now, over the long term, you don't get 24% a year, but over 3 years, the average annualized return is 7.8%. Over 5 years, it's 13.4%. And over 10 years, it's 9.2%. So you'd be able to get slightly less than that due to fees if you stuck your money into a simple global tracker. And the difference in returns over 10 years on that compared to 10 years of leaving your money sat in the premium bonds, unless you get really lucky, is going to be quite substantial. So that's the other thing you need to think about.
Right. Thank you, Simon. Well, Lee mentioned there a little bit earlier, Bitcoin. It's been a rocky time of late for Bitcoin. But could it be about to go proper mainstream? The US regulator gave approval for the launch of 11 Bitcoin ETFs with funds lined up from Wall Street giants BlackRock and Fidelity. Now, it would allow investors to track the price of Bitcoin without buying it. So is this a watershed moment for the world's largest cryptocurrency and the broader crypto industry? Firstly, Simon, ETFs, 101.
Exchange-traded funds. They are a pooled investment scheme, so like an investment fund, but they are traded on the stock market. So their shares are traded on the stock market. So you have, when it comes to investment funds in this country are generally referred to as a catch-all term for a certain type of investment that pulls investors' money together, and either you will have a fund manager trying to pick winners, or you will have a tracker fund which just simply follows a set index, maybe the FTSE 100, the S&P 500, the global stock market like we just talked about. And they are not traded on the stock market. They have unit prices, and the prices tend to be updated once a day. You then have investment trusts. That's set up like a company that is traded on the stock market. But you also have ETFs, which are more like a fund than an investment trust, in that they don't tend to shift around to discounts and premiums, to net asset value and share prices and stuff. But they are constantly traded on the stock market, and they have become a very, very popular way of investing. And they're generally used for tracker type scenarios where they're following a set index, but you can get some fancy ones, which I would steer well clear of, where you've got kind of like they're leveraged, so you're getting 2x returns on certain things. The problem is that when the price falls, you then lose twice as much. So steer away from those. And you actually do get some actively managed ETFs as well. But the big news is that the SEC, the securities regulator in the US, has finally approved Bitcoin ETFs. It's approved a handful of them, basically. And this creates a way for big money to invest in Bitcoin that didn't previously exist. So obviously, you could invest, trade, speculate, put it in whatever box you want to put it into, because some people will say crypto is not investing. And they are, in many cases, for the way people are behaving with it, right? But, you know, there are people out there who could claim to be investors in crypto. So I don't want to upset them either. But regardless of which, the big money in the world, the institutional money, can't really access it, because whilst you, me, Lee, most people listening to this podcast can just go open an account with a trading platform or a specific crypto platform, and then, you know, buy some Bitcoin, buy some Ethereum, you know, you could even go a bit nuts and buy some Dogecoin if you were feeling a bit weird. Then, or you could buy some like really weird stuff, but we won't go into that.
Right, yeah.
That's not really open to the world's fund managers, pension funds, big institutional money, which can't be, you know, opening trading accounts with, you know, eToro or opening Coinbase accounts or things like that. They have to be sort of investing in a certain way. And ETFs are part of the existing financial system. The ETF system is regulated in the US and in the UK, but you won't actually be able to buy these in the UK for the time being. Right. And what this means is that that big institutional money can now back Bitcoin. Now, I wouldn't expect that big institutional money to suddenly flood into Bitcoin. There's still a lot of criticism of Bitcoin, and there's a lot of big institutional investors who wouldn't touch it with a barge pole, just like there's like tiny stocks on the stock market they wouldn't touch with a barge pole. But even if only a very small percentage of the big institutional money in the world went into Bitcoin, it would create quite a lot more demand for Bitcoin.
Because my natural question was, okay, just because they can, would they really want to? Do we want our pensions invested in Bitcoin?
No, not necessarily. But then maybe...
So who would be interested in this?
Well, so they might go, okay, we're going to have a 1% in Bitcoin. It's a... Treat it like you would treat a portfolio investment in a high-risk growth stocks, venture capital, something like that, where you have a portfolio of things and you expect potentially a large number of them to fail, but the winners will win by so much that it delivers long-term returns. This is literally the investment strategy of Scottish Mortgage, one of the country's most popular investment trusts, which basically looks at the asymmetry of returns, which is that, you know, it holds, say, 100 different holdings of companies that it considers to be highly disruptive. You know, it's not necessarily technology, but a lot of it is based on technology, the kind of companies that are going to shape the world in 10 years time. And the fund managers admit that many of those companies will not succeed in doing that, but the ones that do succeed will succeed by such a margin and do so well that it massively outweighs the losses that you get on the rest of the portfolio. So for example, they might be happy to take a 2% stake. If, you know, 2% of the investment trust is held in something that is so highly speculative that you'd be an absolute lunatic to stick 100% of your investments in it. But at 2%, it doesn't do that much damage if it goes wrong. Mm. If it goes right, then it does very, very well. Bitcoin has already demonstrated, you know, the asymmetry of returns. For example, over 1 year, it's up 144%.
Right.
Now, that may make some people who hold small amounts of Bitcoin, yours truly holds a small amount of Bitcoin for this very reason, that, well, what if I'm wrong bit? What if actually this is the future? What if it does keep going up? What if the people who say it's going to go to 100,000 or even higher are right? So I've got a very small amount of my savings and investments in some Bitcoin that I've had for ages. Now, at the moment, that looks great because it's up 144% in a year, but only if I look back 1 year. If I look back to the point where it peaked at more than $60,000, I'm actually down substantially. I'm up on what I bought it for anyway, but like, you know what I mean? Over 5 years, the return looks unbelievable. It's 1,172%. That is largely because the point at which you're comparing it to 5 years ago was when Bitcoin was at a real kind of low point. So, you know, it depends where you start with these things. And if you start at the start, the returns look stratospheric. But so to go back to your question, you've got a massive fund that has like 4 billion, you know, assets that it holds. That's not even that massive in the fund world. And it goes, right, well, we're going to put 1% into Bitcoin. That's a tiny bit of the fund. Most of the investors probably wouldn't object that much, depending on what kind of fund it is, as long as it's not a super, super cautious fund or something like that. If it's a kind of, you know, a growth fund, investors go, okay, fine, you know, stick 1% in. And if you get enough of them doing that, all of that money added together makes up quite a lot of extra new money flowing into Bitcoin that wasn't previously flowing in there. That's the bull case for this. The bear case is that all of that is already in the price of Bitcoin. Everybody knew that this was going to happen. This decision could have gone the other way, at which point I would have expected a massive Bitcoin price crash. It didn't go the other way, but the price didn't go up that much. What that tells you is that most of it was already in the price, okay? It's already anticipated that some of that institutional money is going to go in, and anything can happen, you know, to dent the price of Bitcoin. There could be another massive crypto fraud. It is a world dogged by fraud, crypto. There could be an exchange collapsing. It could be that the US view on interest rates changes dramatically, which has been largely behind a lot of the rise in Bitcoin over the last year, because it's a very kind of high risk asset, and that responds very well to the expectation that interest rates will be cut. Anything could still possibly go wrong. So just because you can buy it in an ETF doesn't make it a safe investment.
Well, the fact that the SEC's Twitter account was hacked, I thought was quite telling before the announcement was made. Lee, it's an interesting sort of, just to sort of veer us off a little bit of subject, but you can veer us back on again. But there does seem to be a bit of a behavioral economics thread running through the last couple of stories. The idea of premium bonds and lotteries and crypto is all like fear of missing out, loss aversion, you know, that risk reward. But what if?
I think there's a lot of people in the same boat as Simon, me included, that just hold a tiny amount thinking, well, you know, if it does shoot up, then I was involved in it. And I think that's what a kind of a lot of people, how people have treated it. I think where the danger comes is where people piled in lots of money, you know, potentially that's their only investment, and they haven't done it as part of a kind of a proper strategy. They've just gone, oh, this is going to the moon, I'm shoving all my money in it. And that's when fingers get burnt. And I think that's what's happened. That's what happened in sort of round one of Bitcoin. But we're kind of entering a different kind of phase here, where this sort of move to the ETFs is a kind of bit more of a legitimizing of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin in particular. And actually, there's some quite punchy predictions out there from proper analysts. So, for example, Standard Chartered's Jeff Kendrick thinks it could hit $100,000 this year and double 12 months after that. He's saying, if ETF-related inflows materialize as we expect, we think an end 2025 level closer to 200,000 is possible. That's Standard Chartered. You know, that's a major bank. But we always talk about predictions, Georgie, don't we? We were saying last week, you know, very hard to make. And then Kathy Wood, founder of ARK Investments, said it could reach $1.5 million by 2030. I mean, I'm doing a proper Dr. Evil there, $1.5 million in the Bitcoin price. But in Britain, so this is all we're talking here a lot about, obviously, US, and yeah, the Twitter hacking was mad. That seemed to drive the price of Bitcoin higher than the actual news that had been given the green light, which was quite odd. But you know, the FCA is still kind of quite cagey about Bitcoin. Yeah. And it wasn't that long ago that it was saying that, you know, crypto is largely unregulated, it's high risk, and those who invest should be prepared to lose all their money. And that goes back to people getting their fingers burnt and potentially putting too much cash into what they think is a sure thing, but might not necessarily be the sure thing. And as we've discussed on this podcast many times before, you need to go and arm yourself with the knowledge of how cryptocurrencies work, how blockchain works, you know, getting really kind of under the skin of what it is and what problems it's solving, and whether it is an appropriate thing for you to hold and get involved in. I mean, I've got a small amount of Bitcoin, but it's really low risk. I did it on Coinbase. Someone sent me a referral code which gave me free Bitcoin. I did a few educational videos, converted those educational videos into Bitcoin, withdrew the small amount that I had to put in cash to get the Bitcoin, and now I've got quite a lot, you know, not quite a lot, but a few hundred quid's worth of Bitcoin, basically skin in the game with no risk. I'm like the opposite of what has happened to quite a few people that have had their fingers burned. What happens next will remains to be seen. There's still quite a lot of things in the world of Bitcoin that are coming up, including a halving, which is coming up, which Simon can explain much better than I can. But that can have a kind of quite a big effect on what Bitcoin price does. So there's a halving in April. Which basically makes Bitcoin harder to mine. Is that right, Simon? Simon knows more about this than I do.
Effectively, it means that people mining Bitcoin don't get as much return. So it creates more scarcity in terms of like the Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin is limited anyway in the amount that will be generated. So I think the other thing to note on this that's really important is that even if you believe in the long-term bull case for Bitcoin, you have to understand that there is massive potential for market manipulation owing to the fact that a very small number of people hold a very large percentage of the total amount of Bitcoin that exists in the world. And so Bitcoin investors are very much at the mercy of these whales and what they decide to do with their Bitcoin. And, you know, were one of those whales to suddenly dump all their Bitcoin at the same time, that would have quite significant impact on the price.
Right. So, Simon, just ever so quickly in sum, just because of what's happening in the States doesn't mean it's all going to come over here and that's it. Crypto's gone. Mainstream's going to hit 1.5 million, according to someone.
Yeah, you can't look. So if you're a UK investor, you can't actually buy these ETFs. They're US ETFs. And unfortunately, UK investors can't buy US ETFs. It's to do with the technical thing because they don't issue key investor documents. This is actually something that on a broader scale, I think, arguably needs sorting out, because the investment world is a global world nowadays. It's very easy to buy overseas stocks. You know, you can buy US stocks as easily as you can buy UK stocks. Buy stocks in many countries as easy as you can buy UK stocks. And I think it is foolish that UK investors cannot easily access US ETFs. And it's to the detriment of those investors because it means that they don't have the full range of choice that others would potentially have. Whether, you know, that changes, I don't know. If that changed, then you would be able to buy the ETF. Whether there'll be approval here, we don't know. But also, I think probably the next step is obviously there'll be some more Bitcoin ETFs that get approval. I would expect to see large growth in that. But I think the next step is people wanting to see something like an Ethereum ETF and stuff like that as well. So for the time being, that's nowhere close.
All right then. Right, some big news this week. Millions of drivers could get a payout after the City Watchdog announced a probe into the motor finance industry. Now, in 2021, the FCA banned something called discretionary commission arrangements between lenders and the dealers that sold credit packages to car buyers. They were seen to incentivize brokers to increase the interest rate that customers pay, often to higher than what the prospective borrower should really be offered. Now, the Watchdog has followed this up with the launch of a review of the practices that were going on. So is this, people are asking, the next PPI scandal? Lee Boyce, if you would, go into more detail. What were discretionary commission arrangements? Indeed, what is car finance? For anyone who's never used it, doesn't know how it works, how does it work?
Well, there's different ways of financing a car and how you buy it. You know, it depends whether you're on a kind of one of those where you pay some money up front, have the car for 3 years, and then you even make a balloon payment and return the car, and you keep going on a kind of conveyor belt of doing that every 3 years. Whether you're just actually buying the car outright, and essentially, if you go into a car dealership, quite often, you know, these kind of financial packages were pushed on people because it helps make dealerships money. The long and short of it, you know, that's how they make some of their cash, by you know, getting people on finance, taking some cut of the interest. Happy days. And I think that it kind of seems, the FCA seems to think that this has spiraled out of control somewhat, hence the banning, and now hence the retrospective look back at what was happening in some of these dealerships and how some of these packages were being pushed on people, and whether actually, you know, not necessarily if you need to buy a car, do you need to take finance out at a dealership? You know, there might be a cheaper alternative way of financing the car, for example, through your bank for a personal loan, especially before 2021. Personal loan rates were incredibly low, and whether buyers were fully aware of all of their options. And the hunch is, in my mind, that the answer is probably not. And I think that actually a really good explanation here about what was going on. We've got in our story, Stuart Mason, editorial director at The Car Expert, He said that card dealerships had the ability on many deals to manipulate the interest rate to suit the commission being paid to the dealer. So if they wanted to discount to a certain level, they would do what they could do to make the car cheaper. But of course, that was never really disclosed. So they might have made the car, the sort of purchase price a bit cheaper, but they might have made the rate of interest a bit higher in order to sort of like make up the difference. That kind of practice, you know, it just reeks of not being fair to the buyer and not being fair to the consumer. And fair play to the FCA for actually kind of really getting their teeth stuck into this and having a look what was going on. And also, we've got a comment here from Steve Clayton at Hargreaves, who's saying these arrangements had been seen to incentivize brokers to sell higher cost loans than were appropriate for the riskiness of the prospective borrower. So it also sounds like there was some sort of manipulation going around in terms of, you know, making sure that people could actually finance the car when perhaps they weren't, it wasn't appropriate for them. It's very broad brush to say absolutely every single dealership in the country was doing this. And this is, they haven't named any names. So they're kind of keeping their cards close to their chest in that regard, looking at who it is potentially that has been doing this. But you're looking here, Georgie, at millions of car financing deals that would have been made sort of every year. How far and how far back this will go and how far back they will look at, I don't know. And whether this will be the next PPI remains to be seen. But you've got to remember that buying a car, of course, is usually the second most expensive purchase that you make after a home. Average borrowing on a new car, according to Stuart Mason, $25,000 on a new car. And on a used car, it's $10,000. So we're talking five-figure sums here. If people have lost out because the rates were higher than what they should have been, or it wasn't appropriate for them, you can see how this could unfold pretty rapidly. And especially with the arsenal of having the FCA behind it, I can quite easily see how this could develop into the next sort of ambulance chasing PPI scandal.
Oh yeah, ambulance chasers. So this is, obviously this might be a bit of a legal question, Lee, but you said obviously not every dealership would have been doing this, but you know, many could have been, and that's what the FCA want to investigate. But when there's millions over years, how can the FCA kind of pick and choose? Is that when they sort of say, do you know what, actually anyone who had this, you're going to get some money back? Like, what can the FCA actually do, or likely to do, have said that they can do here? I mean, are we really going to get some money back? I've never bought a car by car finance, so I never had PPI either.
Well, the review's going on at the moment. I mean, this is a kind of question and the question that we've put to experts, whether or not, you know, really, realistically, everyone can go back and claim for every single car that they've bought on finance. It gets very difficult to kind of keep on top of that. And, you know, it will probably rely on people having kept quite solid paperwork, for example, and whether people actually do that or not. And it hasn't been really made that clear by the FCA if the onus would be on the consumer or the dealership to put things right. That's quite a crucial key part of this, but it's ongoing. So, you know, on one hand, we could say this could be the next PPI scandal. On the other hand, we haven't had the full FCA kind of feedback of what they've discovered. This will be a real, real deep dive, tricky job. I'd imagine that they've had some whistleblowers, for example, that have probably sort of blown the lid on some of the behaviours and some of the kind of practices that were being pushed. Because let's face it, you know, if you're working in a dealership, you're a car salesperson, you know, the kind of pressure is on to sell cars, and you will do that by any means necessary. And you might have had certain tools in your arsenal that you might have been able to make that happen, including what we just described. And as I say, people have been left out of pocket. I mean, the PPI thing was huge. I mean, it was absolutely huge, and the onus was on the banks. They footed the bill. They footed the kind of administration of that. Will that be pushed on the FCA onto dealerships if it found that there is widespread bad behaviour? Well, that kind of remains to be seen.
Well, what would that mean? And I'll grab you into this conversation, Simon. What will that mean for car sales kind of going forward? Are dealerships just going to shut down? Are cars going to get more expensive? Like, if they do have to fork out all of this money, are they going to be able to afford to? Who's going to pay ultimately?
Well, there's already a bit of a squeeze on this, owing to the rise in interest rates. So a lot of this was through the 0% or near 0% interest rate era. So that was much easier for car finance companies. And, you know, there's big names sitting behind these car finance. It's a big industry and there's big money here. And when you had 0% finance deals, it was much easier for the car dealerships to structure it so that you could afford the car. And what you're doing with a PCP deal, which is the way most new cars are bought, is you're effectively funding the depreciation in the car. And then, as Lee said, you have that balloon payment. So say you do it over 3 years, they do a calculation of what the price of that car is going to be in 3 years' time. And then you pay that off on a monthly basis. And if you pay that off at 0%, it's definitely cheaper than 5%. That's definitely cheaper than 9%. The impact of rising interest rates has been that it's much harder for dealerships to offer those kind of 0% offers. There's still a few, but effectively that's a lost leader now. And, you know, the natural rate, even taken at, you know, very kind of low interest rate levels, is much, much higher. And then you add a little bit on for the profit. Now, the reason why dealers were willing to sell, dealers don't actually make that much money on new cars when they sell them in general. And the reason why they're willing to discount them so much is because they make money off other things. They make money off finance agreements, and they make money off of servicing and maintenance in the future. Things have tightened up a bit. This does refer to stuff before a certain point in 2021. The one thing I would say is, like, it's not to say it's the new PPI, but drawing a comparison with the PPI thing, that was widespread mis-selling on a massive scale after many people had warned that PPI was being mis-sold on a widespread massive scale and reported on it for a long time. And the banks continue to do it for years and years and years until they stopped. And a lot of people making PPI claims got PPI claims paid out, maybe when they shouldn't have done, because the banks had really bad record keeping. And there was so much of this stuff being flogged that they couldn't really find the evidence that showed they'd flogged it properly. So they had to, they were like, okay, just pay them. I have had people from banks tell me that they think they paid out PPI money to people who didn't even have PPI in the first place, but that person made a PPI claim, said they were missold, and they couldn't prove that they didn't have it. I mean, can you imagine that? Like a high street bank paying out on someone being missold insurance that the person may not have even had in the first place, but basically it didn't have the records it needed to show. And this wasn't like, we think we've paid out to one person. This was, we think there's maybe a percentage that we're paying out to who never actually had PPI. Then we think there's also a percentage in there who knew that they were getting PPI, were told they were getting PPI, were told how much the PPI was costing them, but we can't prove that we didn't missell it to them. So we're paying them as well. So you can understand why this could turn into potentially quite a big thing, owing to this being finance agreements that were largely sold to people by car salesmen.
Goodness me. Well, I'm sure this will go on, probably not with any speed, because these sort of investigation things tend not to go that quickly. But anyway, Lee, we're going to stick with motors being ripped off. You have written about the loyalty penalty striking again after you got a renewal quote for your car insurance. Lee, tell us how much they were proposing that your car insurance should go up by.
Well, last year I wrote about this, Georgie. So, I mean, I'm a kind of litmus test for where car insurance prices are going, because our car insurance is always up at the start of January. So we get the renewal quote, it lands on the mat. I opened it with trepidation, think, oh, how much are they going to sting me by this year? Except I believe that the loyalty penalty was meant to be stamped out and I wouldn't need to sort of go through all this anymore. I thought, you know, it would just be a fair price. You know, they're just pricing it how it should be. Because if you go back to January 2022, the FCA said that it was going to collectively save Britain's billions of pounds by banning the insurance loyalty penalty. It's that kind of thing where, you know, they're renewing customers onto higher premiums for a like-to-like policy and hoping to catch them out, basically, while offering new customers better deals. I thought all of that from that January 2022 line from the FCA meant things were going to improve. Well, last year, our renewal quote came through January 2023, I'll take you back, and it was up 21%, the quote. Now, that's the highest auto renewal we've ever had. No circumstances changed, still in the same address, still the same drivers. Only thing that's different is the car has got a little bit more mileage on the clock, so it's presumably worth a little bit less. But we went away, we crunched some comparison figures, et cetera, et cetera. We'd been with the same insurer. I mean, talking about loyalty, we'd been with the same insurer for more than a decade with the car insurance. They'd always treated us quite fairly. The price was always roughly the same. It never felt like we were overpaying. But it all came to a halt, and we had to leave that insurer. They couldn't match a quote. They couldn't even offer us a slightly cheaper price. So we went off. I was annoyed, but we managed to get a better price elsewhere. So this year came through the renewal quote, 46.5% increase.
Lordly. Wow.
Again, absolutely.
Can you explain why?
Absolutely. Nothing has changed. And I just cannot get my head around how in any way, shape or form, that isn't the very thing the FCA was talking about in January 2022, the loyalty penalty. It doesn't make any sense. So phone them up. Let's get an explanation. What's going on? Please justifiably tell me what is going on to make it 46.5% rising cost of labour. That's what you said last year. So how many years do we just keep saying it's the rising cost of labour? You've got to come up with a better excuse for me this year. Rising cost of labour. And that was the official line. Last year we had a rising cost of labour and something mumbled about the postcode, which I just couldn't quite figure out. Perhaps there'd been car break-ins and things like that. I know there's been quite a rise in that. But it still just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And it can never be, they can never quite really tell you fully in detail what's going on, because the Tenery, it's, you know, labour and car parts got more expensive. Okay, so break it down for me for my actual make and model of car. You know, go and tell me exactly what has gone up 46.5%. And, you know, the answer never comes. So got grumpy again, had to obviously crunch figures elsewhere. In fact, actually, before we made the phone call about the renewal quote, made sure we went on a comparison website to find some better deals. Because if you're going to go into battle with your insurer, you need to be armed with quotes and to sort of throw them at them, but they couldn't be matched. So we're just going to have to change insurer again. You know, it's not the biggest deal, and you know, that's where comparison websites are a useful tool, but it shouldn't be like this. I don't know why it has to be so complicated, and why we have to sort of do this sort of haggle dance every single year. It just makes no sense to me. I think what really gets me is that I can never be given a really fully sort of developed sort of reasons, you know, just to say that is just quite an arbitrary thing. I can't get my head around that. But it doesn't make any sense.
You're a financial expert. You've been looking at the inflation figures. Is there anything in the figures that said actually, you know, car parts are up almost 50%? Cost of service up almost 50%. I don't know. Like, I've been to a car garage to get my car fixed. It's gone up, but I don't think it's gone up that much.
Oh, there's no, I'm not saying that it hasn't. I'm not saying that labor and cost parts, but that's what I said last year. That's what, you know, now in year two of this. So it's when this happens again next year, inevitably probably going to happen again next year. Are they going to say cost of labor and parts have gone up again? I don't know. I mean, how long can you keep on saying that for? Is a sort of question that I don't understand. We were talking about this, weren't we, a little while back. Insurance just feels like it has got a lot more expensive last year for everyone. Car insurance, home insurance, all of that stuff. We were talking about the insurance premium tax, how the Treasury now takes in almost £7.5 billion a year from IPT compared to less than £3 billion in 2014-15. That's helped put the price of premiums up, no doubt. But I think what it is as a kind of motorist, it's, you see it as almost being besmirched. It's like you're charging me more insurance despite the fact that once again I haven't claimed, once again my circumstances haven't changed. You're telling me the car's worth less money than it was last year. So all of those things are sort of whirling around in my brain, and that to me equals cheaper quote, cheaper cover, but it doesn't. And that's got me annoyed.
And you're going away, aren't you? You're leaving them.
We're leaving. Bye-bye. And the other thing I think is quite interesting about this, so I know we're going to sort of talk about some tips for saving a car insurance. So obviously comparison websites are just a really useful way of, and everyone knows that. I mean, that's not really what you need to hear. It's not like, you know that. You can go on a comparison website. What these insurers are hoping is that a certain proportion of people will auto renew. And also, it is better than what it once was in terms of transparency, because now your insurer has to put last year's quote and last year's price in the letter very prominently, so you can compare how much has gone up. So as soon as I got that, and I was like, got the calculator out, working out the percentage, I'm straight on it. But the other thing is that the FCA were talking about this week, going back to the FCA, is about the penalty for not being able to pay annually for your car insurance. Yeah. So you will get a discount if you pay annually on your car insurance. And if you pay monthly, you'll get charged. Typically, you get charged interest. Not everyone can afford to pay for their car insurance up front. And the FCA are looking at sort of banning that practice, that makes it more expensive for people to pay for their insurance monthly. So I thought that was quite an interesting little tip. But since the FCA has got motoring on its mind at the moment, yeah. So you know, other tips, you know, you need to think about all of the things that you're inputting. You know, are you putting in too many miles? You know, have a look back. Some people do undercook the mileage, but some people also overcook the amount of miles that they typically drive in a year. So it's worth thinking about that, and how many drivers you've got in the car. You know, could you potentially get away with removing someone off the car if they're not using it very often? You can increase your access, your voluntary access. That brings the cost down. But of course, if you do need to make a claim, you could end up out of pocket by having to pay more of the excess when you do claim. And making sure that when you are inputting the details, you're being completely, most people are very safe with what they do with their car and where they leave the car. You know, if it's on a driveway or somewhere very secure, and lots of people have kind of devices that make it hard to steal a car, especially if you've got a desirable prestige brand that are being targeted. And make sure you put all of that into your quote, so that the insurer knows that hopefully you're a bit less of a risk because you've got all of these devices and systems in place that hopefully prevent your car being nabbed, are some of the things. But I think a lot of these things people already know, if I'm being frank.
Well, it doesn't hurt though, Lee. It doesn't hurt to hear it again. Right, finally, anybody doing dry January?
I don't do dry January, and I'm totally anti dry January. I'm anti anything that gets itself a name. I'm also anti dry January because we once had the most po-faced email I have ever seen from the dry, because dry January is a trademark. Well, I don't know if it's a trademark, but dry January is something that claims to be only allowed to be used by dry January. Dry January is a thing. It's not just something you can call dry January. It's an official name. And we got told we weren't allowed to use the phrase dry January in a story unless we refer to it in a certain way. To which my response was, emails like that don't really endear you to people. And also it's a generally used phrase and you can't claim it for your own. But what I will say is that I do tend to not drink in January.
Right.
Contrary. Yeah,
that's fine. But you actually, call it whatever you want.
I'm gonna offer up my defense here that my wife is always like, "Will you shut up?" Right. Okay. I've done this.
That generally, or about dry January?
No. Well, about many.
It's a relationship show. Do you want to forget on the couch?
Specifically on this
Simon?
One, this is why she tells me to shut up on this one.
Right.
I've been doing this for a really long time, since before dry January was a thing. Right.
Yeah.
Because my dad always used to do it. My dad always used to not drink in January. Apart from, and I've followed this tradition, when he went away skiing for a weekend and on his birthday, which was the 25th. Me and my wife started doing this not drinking in January thing when we were in our early 20s. And it was more a kind of like, after the festive excess, it was quite nice to not drink, to get good sleep. And actually, it makes more of a difference with every year that passes. And also, it acts as just like a bit of a reset. It slows you down. I think the problem we have with alcohol in the UK, and the problem we have with drinking, it's the speed at which we drink. We drink so much faster than continental Europeans, right?
Mm.
I am not drinking at the moment, but I will make an exception when we go away snowboarding for a weekend.
Got it.
Because like you, only a fool would do that, wouldn't they?
Right.
And for my wife's birthday, which funnily enough is on the exact same day that my dad's was. And also I didn't start until Monday because I had last week off.
Right. So, okay.
I might as well start when my holidays stop. You know what? As I said, only a fool would do that. Why would you that's like true. You've got a week off? Why wouldn't you let yourself go to the pub and have a beer? Right. So I will continue it probably into mid-February to make up for it.
Right.
Therefore, it's not dry January, is it?
No, it just sounds like drinking. Interesting.
So now we shift back into the here's how you can go to the pub and still have a nice time.
Well, quite. If anyone's wondering what the heck are we talking about dry January for, there is a financial reason for this. I'm actually doing dry January, but I'm a bit like, so I don't really notice it. I've tried stopping coffee. I got 11 days in and then that was it. I just couldn't carry on anymore. It wasn't good for me or society.
This is actually a massive exception to how I normally treat this. Normally, I refuse to tell people that I'm not drinking.
Right.
Okay, because I just keep
my mouth. We feel honoured, Simon, but let's be honest, I hate that whole thing that people do,
making a big fuss about not drinking so much that it's got to the point where I'm just like, I just don't tell people.
Right.
So I've obviously totally ruined that by talking about it on the podcast.
No, that's absolutely fine because I actually do think you are still drinking just at different times. But anyway, that be that as it may.
I haven't had a drink since Sunday.
Is that it, Simon? That doesn't count. That's rubbish. Anyway, Lee Boyce. Yes, but dry January is not just for January. It can be... No, look, we're talking about zero alcohol beverages. Now, Lee Boyce, I remember, I couldn't believe it was 4 years ago, when you went to Adnams, the brewer. They do produce good ales. They also produce a zero alcohol beer. Now, they've been talking to you recently and they've been saying that this actually accounts for a quarter of all of their sales, not just January, throughout the year. We've been doing this podcast now. We're in our 10th year. Way. We've been talking about zero alcohol booze for a while. The growth is huge. Tell me about it, Lee.
Yeah, it's been exceptional. So the trip you're talking about there, I went to Adnams actually just before the pandemic, and I was doing a feature about sort of low alcohol beer and where the future of it was going. And Adnams was one of very few brewers that actually invested properly in a kind of alcohol-free version of their beer. So Ghost Ship, very popular ale, and they decided to brew a 0.5% version, which launched in 2018. Now, on Friday night, I actually found myself in a Weatherspoons with my mate. We were just in there. I'm not doing dry January. I don't believe in all of that, but I am at the moment. I do believe.
What do you not believe in? People not drinking.
No, I hate the terminology of it all around it. Drink responsibly, please, if you're listening to this podcast. But yeah, no, I'm just off it at the moment. We went to Weatherspoons, and my mate's not drinking either. And instead of going into the pub, and if you weren't drinking before, it's kind of like, oh, I'll have a Diet Coke or a lemonade or something. Mm. It's quite nice to actually go and buy a good quality low alcohol beer. So I got a Ghost Ship, my friend got an Erdinger, £2.98 for the round. I mean, I'll take that and pour it into the glass and you'd never know the difference because it's
really?
It's really well made. Yeah, it's really, really well made. I think Ghost Ship 0.5% is a great example of how to transition to make a very good low alcohol beer. Now, there'll be lots of people listening to this going, well, am I going to drink a beer without alcohol and it'll just have water? Which is fine. You know, I completely understand why people might have that viewpoint, but I think it's quite nice just to have something a bit different that doesn't make you feel like you're missing out. And I think that's kind of where this all goes. Now, actually, recently, the founder of Lucky Saint, now Lucky Saint is a beer brand that's done very, very well. And it only makes 0% beer. It doesn't have any other drinks. They recently launched a hazy IPA. The reason I know that is that I'm a customer of Lucky Saint and I do actually buy directly from the website quite frequently because my wife quite likes a 0.5% beer. Of course, being pregnant is a good thing for her to have, again, to make it feel like she's not missing out. He was saying basically in an interview recently that their sales don't rely at all on dry January. You know, it's a year-round business. Right. People are making purchases steadily throughout the entire year. And that includes me. And I thought that's quite interesting. So the reason why I'm talking about going to Spoons on Friday, last Friday, was I wondered how much ghost ship that Adams were actually selling and how much it actually makes up. So Angharad Karak, our reporter, went and asked them, and actually it accounts for 26% of all of its ghost ship sales now. And ghost ship is its number one bestseller. Ghost ship 0.5% is now its number two bestseller. So it's done very well. Again, saying the same sort of thing. This isn't just a dry January business. This is a year-round thing that people have actually swapped out and are drinking it. And I think that's a really interesting kind of move. You know, when companies like Adnams and when Lucky Sane are actually taking care and attention, it's not just an afterthought. It's not just something that they're pegging on. And also Guinness 0% has been a massively popular launch that came a couple of years ago, and the Guinness owners were saying that 1 in 10 Guinness sales could soon be for its 0% version of the beer. I mean, that's quite incredible in my mind. I think that's quite an amazing thing. And actually, I put it out there on Twitter in the week, George, just find out what people kind of thought about it. And actually, a lot of people saying, yeah, like the ghost shit 0.5%. There was a lot of love for the Peroni 0%.
Yeah, that's 0%.
All. There's all options out there. And it's a really growing segment of the business. And I think anything that encourages us to drink a bit less alcohol from time to time is a good thing.
No, it's funny though. I mean, I last did dry January, don't know why, 2017, but I thought it'd be a good opportunity to try all the different types of beers. And I'll be honest with you, some of them were just rancid that it got to the state. I mean, some were okay, but it's like a corn burger and saying it's the same as a beef burger. It's not. Yeah. I'd rather just have something completely different. So I'm a soda and lime girl now. But now you've said that, Lee, not for between this week and next week, I'm going to go out there into the great wide pub and I'm going to try their offerings. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all podcast past and join in the debate in reader comments and tell us what your favourite non-alcoholic beer is. Lee's already asked you that question, so tell us.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.